Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Carrie Curtis, a member of the club's Board of Governors and the co-chair of the club's Environment and Natural Resources Forum, and your chair for this evening's program. We also welcome our listeners on the radio. Today, we will hear from a world-renowned energy expert, Amory Lovins. Amory is a consultant physicist and is among the world's leading energy experts in energy and its links with resources, security, development, and environment. He has advised the energy industry and other industries for four decades, as well as the U.S. Departments of Energy and Defense. His work in over 50 countries has been recognized by the Alternative Nobel and the MacArthur Grant and too many other honors and awards for me to list them all. We'd be here for another 10 minutes while I listed them all. Dr. Lovins claims to be a Harvard and Oxford dropout. There's a story there, I'm sure, and a former Oxford Don, and has briefed many heads of state and advises major firms and governments worldwide. In 1982, he co-founded the Rocky Mountain Institute, where he still is as chairman and chief scientist. Rocky Mountain Institute is an independent, market-oriented, entrepreneurial, nonprofit, nonpartisan, think-and-do tank whose goal is to create abundance by design. He is here to speak about his most recent book, Reinventing Fire, Bold Business Solutions for a New Energy Era. Other recent books by Dr. Lovins are Small is Profitable, The Hidden Economic Benefits of Making Electrical Resources the Right Size, and Winning the Oil Endgame. He is also the co-author of the classic business book, Natural Capitalism, which I use in my classes that I teach. In 2009, Time named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world, and Foreign Policy named him one of the 100 top global thinkers. Please welcome me in joining Amory Lovins.
Thank you. After that, after that generous introduction, I can't wait to hear what I'm going to say. Fire made us human. Fossil fuels made us modern. And now we need a new fire that can make us safe, secure, and durable. Rocky Mountain Institute, therefore, aims to shift the United States, for starters, completely off oil and coal to efficiency and renewable energy. And our peer-reviewed grant synthesis, Reinventing Fire, just released, details how saving and displacing fossil fuel can work better and cost less than buying and burning it. 4/5 of today's energy, though, still comes from fossil fuels. About 4 cubic miles a year of the stuff is burned worldwide. They built our civilization, created our wealth, enriched the lives of billions. Yet their rising costs to our security, economy, health, environment are eroding and starting to outweigh their benefits, starting to undermine the prosperity and security they created. So we need a new fire. Our energy system today is disconnected, aging, and inefficient. It needs refurbishment. And switching from the old fire to the new fire takes two big shifts in oil and in electricity. And these stories are distinct because less than 1% of our oil makes electricity, but about 95% of our coal makes electricity. Oil and power stations each release 2/5 of the world's fossil carbon, and 3/4 of the electricity runs buildings, while 3/4 of the oil fuels mobility. The remaining electricity and oil run factories. So very efficient vehicles, buildings, and factories save a lot of oil and coal and also save natural gas that can displace both of them. So the system we envisage for 2050 is quite different. It's efficient, connected, and distributed. Where super efficient autos and buildings and factories all rely on a secure and modern electricity system. And there will be no need for coal or oil or even nuclear energy once efficiency and renewables end our addiction to fossil fuels. Creating the core industries of this new energy era could cost $5 trillion less in net present value than business as usual, and yet support 158% bigger U.S. economy. In other words, 2.6 times today's. This transition needs no new inventions, no new federal taxes, subsidies, mandates, or laws, thus end running Washington gridlock. And it assumes that carbon emissions and all the other externalities, all the hidden costs, are worth zero, a conservatively low estimate. So let me say that again. I'm going to tell you how the United States can get completely off oil and coal, $5 trillion cheaper, with no act of Congress led by business for profit. So whether you care most about profits and jobs and competitive advantage, or about national security, or about health and environmental stewardship, reinventing fire makes sense and makes money. General Eisenhower allegedly said that expanding the boundaries of a tough problem makes it soluble by encompassing new options, new degrees of freedom, new synergies. So reinventing fire integrates all four energy-using sectors: transportation, buildings, industry, and electricity. It also integrates four kinds of innovation: technology, design, which is how we combine technologies, policy, and business strategy, new business models, new competitive strategies. And these combinations are a lot more powerful than the sum of the parts, especially in creating deeply disruptive business opportunities. Let's start with oil. America burns oil costing about $2 billion a day, and yet we also pay in our taxes and wealth and health hidden costs of at least $4 billion a day. So the total cost is upwards of $2 trillion a year. And the $1.5 trillion a year of hidden costs comes in three roughly equal parts. The first is the costs to the macroeconomy of the treasure transfer, the costs of extra OPEC price that they're able to charge largely because of our oil dependence and what it does to world oil markets, and also macroeconomic costs from dislocations to our economy when there's an oil shock. Another $0.5 trillion a year is the market value of oil's price volatility, which is a microeconomic cost to everybody that uses oil. And of course, in the larger picture, for 40 years now, as oil prices whipsaw the economy, every oil price spike has preceded a recession. But that cost of the jittery price is something that we all see as a risk and cost in our businesses and our households. And then we pay another $0.5 trillion a year to sustain military forces whose primary mission is intervention in the Persian Gulf. That's 10 times what we pay for oil from the Persian Gulf, and it rivals our total defense spending at the height of the Cold War. There is, of course, another set of national interests in the region besides just oil, but it's really hard to believe we would have invaded there twice in recent years if Kuwait and Iraq just grew broccoli. Oil is also finite. The Pentagon is preparing to need no oil, and the rest of us should too. Even if oil were not costing in all upwards of a sixth of GDP, plus any cost to health, environment, and our nation's independence and reputation, none of which I've counted so far. And by the way, all of these external costs that I've just enumerated are not in our analysis, which is based just on market price and what you can save, therefore, in not having to buy the oil. Now, automobiles use 3/5 of our mobility fuel. So how can we make autos oil-free? 2/3 of the energy needed to move a 2-ton steel car is caused by its weight. For the past quarter century, though, epidemic obesity has made our cars gain weight twice as fast as we have. But ultralight, ultra-strong materials like carbon fiber composites can make dramatic weight savings snowball and can make autos simpler and cheaper to build. Lighter, more slippery autos need less force to move them, so their propulsion system gets smaller and their vehicle fitness then makes electric autos affordable because their batteries or fuel cells get smaller, simpler, lighter, and cheaper. Of course, super-efficient electric autos then ultimately, when you make a bunch, end up matching today's autos in sticker price, and they will cost far less to build. So these innovations can transform automakers from wringing tiny innovations out of Victorian steel stamping and engine technologies to the steeply falling costs of three very synergistic learning curves, one in the ultralight materials, another in how they're manufactured into structures, and a third in electric propulsion. Sales can grow and prices drop even faster with a temporary feebate. That means rebates to efficient new autos paid for by fees on inefficient ones. In the first 2 years, the biggest of five European feebate programs has tripled the speed of improving automotive efficiency. The resulting shift to electric autos is going to be as game-changing as shifting from small refinements in typewriters to the Moore's Law-driven improvements in computers. Of course, computers and electronics are now America's biggest industry, while typewriter makers have vanished. So vehicle fitness opens a new automotive competitive strategy that can double our oil savings over the next 40 years and can make affordable the electrification that then saves the rest of the oil. Leaders will beat laggards in this race, just as Toyota's bold jump into hybrid cars 14 years ago is still challenging competitors to catch up, only faster because hybrid cars have only one learning curve, not three, that strongly reinforce each other. America could lead this automotive revolution. Currently, the leader is Germany. This year, Volkswagen announced 2013 production of a 230-mile-a-gallon carbon fiber plug-in hybrid electric two-seat car. And BMW announced 2013 production of a four-seat carbon fiber electric car. They confirmed that its carbon fiber is paid for by its fewer batteries. And its BMW CEO said, "We do not intend to be a typewriter maker." Audi claimed it's going to beat both these companies to market by year. Even faster and cheaper new manufacturing technologies like those used to make this carbon fiber bowl, which you can tell is extremely stiff and strong, makes a pretty good carbon cap too, and that was made in less than a minute. Such techniques can scale to automotive speed and cost with aerospace performance and save 4/5 of automaking's capital needs. So if we make our cars and light trucks out of such materials, it saves half the weight and half the fuel, so it's equivalent to finding a Saudi Arabia by drilling in the Detroit formation, very prospective play. The autos get safer because this stuff can absorb 12 times as much crash energy per pound as steel, and the car costs the same to make because the costlier materials are paid for by a smaller propulsion system and much simpler automaking, needing, as I mentioned, 80% less capital. Now, the same physics and the same business logic also apply to bigger vehicles. For example, Walmart saved 60% of the fuel in its heavy truck fleet, the biggest civilian truck fleet in the world, just in the past 5 years. That included some logistical improvements. But the purely technological improvement actually could rise to two-thirds, and combined with the doubled or tripled efficiency or even better airplanes that are coming at us, can save altogether nearly $1 trillion net present value. Today's military revolution in energy efficiency is going to speed up oil savings in the civilian sector, which uses 50-odd times more oil than the military, in much the same way that military R&D has already given us things like the Internet, the global positioning system, and the microchip and jet engine industries. The driver for this is the enormous cost in blood and treasure for the military to deliver fuel to the platforms that are going to use it in the battle space. But in the past, we designed those things as if the delivery of the fuel were free and invulnerable. Actually, it increases the cost of the fuel by somewhere between roughly tenfold and a hundredfold, depending on circumstances. And now the military is starting to count that extra value, which is driving remarkable innovation. And that is going to go first into military land, sea, and air vehicles, but then it will come back to the civilian vehicles and help lead the nation off oil, which is a huge national security win. Imagine a world where you don't have the oil-fed tyrannies and terrorism, and where it doesn't look like everything America does is about oil, where we can have normal relations with countries that export oil as if they didn't. And also, I think that's a world in which each combatant command gets freed of its oil guarding duties, you know, guarding pipelines in far Afghanistan, and we can have mega missions in the Persian Gulf, mission unnecessary. You can imagine the warfighters really like that idea. As we design and build vehicles better, we can also use them smarter. If you think of the morning and evening rush hours and the congestion that we suffer each day in them, think of that as an electricity load shape. If it were an electricity load shape, think how much pricing and IT-enabled smart grid stuff and demand response we would throw at it to try to flatten out those peaks to avoid idle power plants and grids. But by not doing this for road traffic, we are wasting many billions of dollars a year in idle people, idle vehicles, and idle roads. Well, we don't have to keep doing that because now we have four powerful ways to cut needless driving. We can charge real-time driving costs per mile, not per gallon. In fact, we have to do that because otherwise the Highway Trust Fund continues to go broke as cars get more efficient and they switch fuels to things that are hard to tax. We also can use smart IT to enhance transit and enable car sharing and ride sharing. We can allow and encourage lucrative smart growth and new urbanist real estate models so that people are already largely where they want to be and don't need to go somewhere else. And we can also use intelligent transportation systems to make traffic free-flowing. Together, those four innovations have the proven potential to save another $0.4 trillion by reducing our driving 46 to 84% for the same or better access with less time, less money, less hassle. And then we save another $0.3 trillion from smarter use of trucks. So 40 years hence, putting all this together, a far more mobile U.S. economy with 90% more driving, 118% more trucking, 56% more flying, can use no oil, saving $4 trillion net present value. The automobile is getting the equivalent of 125 to 240 miles a gallon, will run on some unknowable mixture of hydrogen, electricity, perhaps advanced biofuels, and trucks and planes can run on advanced biofuels or hydrogen. Trucks can also run on natural gas, but no vehicles will need oil. And the biofuel needed a maximum of 3 million barrels a day compared to our present oil use in the vicinity of 20 for everything. will be so little that it can be produced with no cropland and without harming soil fertility or climate. In fact, it could take carbon out of the air and put it back in the soil where it belongs and pay the farmers and ranchers for doing that. Our team speeds up these kinds of oil savings by what we call institutional acupuncture. That is, we figure out where the business logic is congested and not flowing properly. We stick little needles in it to get it flowing, working with partners like Ford and Walmart and the Pentagon. I think actually the half dozen sectors that need to be transformed are mostly already at or near their tipping point where this long effort starts to get easier because the business logic is so compelling. In fact, a couple of years ago, mainstream analysts started to see peak oil not in supply but in demand. The Wall Street Journal reported that ExxonMobil agreed U.S. gasoline use had peaked in 2007 and will only decline. Dan Yergin said that all the industrialized countries, the OECD countries, total oil use had peaked at the beginning of 2005 and will only go down. And Deutsche Bank forecast that world oil use will peak around 2016 and then by 2030 decline to about 8% below now, or about 40% below the consensus forecast. That was just based on electrification of light vehicles at about a third the pace that China was expecting to do. But these electrified vehicles don't need to burden the electricity system. Rather, when smart vehicles exchange electricity and information through smart buildings with a smart grid, they bring to the grid new storage and flexibility resources that actually help integrate solar and wind power into the grid. So electrified autos converge the oil story with our second big story, saving electricity and then making it differently. Those two revolutions promise for electricity more numerous, profound, and diverse disruptions than in any other sector, because we have basically 21st century technologies and speed colliding with 20th and 19th century institutions, rules, and cultures to create one of those fabulous inflection points, the biggest since at least the Internet, maybe bigger than that, where vast fortunes will be made and lost. Now, changing how we make electricity gets a lot easier if we need less of it. Most of our electricity today is wasted, and the technologies for saving it keep improving faster than we install them. So the efficiency resource we can still capture keeps getting bigger and cheaper. Over the next 40 years, buildings can triple their energy productivity, saving $1.4 trillion net present value. The internal rate of return is 33%. The savings are worth four times what they cost. An industry can double its energy productivity with an internal rate of return of 21%. Very attractive investments. That's all with conventional technologies. But there's an even more disruptive innovation that we've been hatching at RMI called integrative design, which can often turn diminishing returns to investments in energy efficiency into expanding returns. That is, it can often make very big energy savings cost less than small or no savings. And that's how our retrofit last year is saving over two-fifths of the energy in the Empire State Building. Remanufacturing the 6,500 windows on site into super windows that are essentially perfect in letting in light without heat, plus improved lights and office equipment and other things, together cut the peak cooling load by a third. And then instead of having to expand and replace the old chillers, we could renovate them in place and reduce them. And that saved $17 million, which helped pay for the other improvements, thus yielding a three-year payback on the incremental investment. If you do the same trick, retrofitting a typical all-glass and no windows 20-year-old curtain wall office tower, say in Chicago, you can end up saving three-quarters of the energy at a slightly lower cost than the regular 20-year renovation that saves nothing. The same approach can also increase the $500 billion of conventional savings in industry. For example, 3/5 of the world's electricity runs motors. Half of that runs fans and pumps. And you can save about half of all the motor energy with about a 1-year payback by integrating 35 improvements. But first, there are a lot of big savings further downstream in the pipes and ducts that should be captured first. For example, pumps are the biggest use of motors. They move liquid through pipes. A colleague of ours redesigned a typical industrial pumping loop to save at least 86% of the pumping energy and cost less to build just by replacing long, thin, crooked pipes with fat, short, straight pipes. Not rocket science, just good Victorian engineering rediscovered. That's how some recent biotech plant pumping or piping saved 69% of the friction and pumping energy, or how in our house we put in some new piping and it saved about 97%, both at lower cost. So what do such savings mean for the electricity that's 3/5 used in motors? Well, from the coal burned in the power plant to the flow out the pipe, there are so many compounding losses that only a tenth of the fuel you feed into the system actually comes out the other end. However, if you turn those compounding losses around backwards, then every unit of flow or friction you save in the pipes saves 10 units of coal and cost and pollution and what Hunter Lovins calls global weirding back at the power plant. Also, as you go back upstream, the components get smaller, so they get cheaper, and you save the most capital. Our team has lately found such snowballing energy savings in more than $30 billion worth of industrial redesigns, from data centers and chip fabs to mines and refineries. Typically, our retrofit designs save about 30 to 60% of the energy with a 2 or 3 year payback, while our new facility designs save more, say 40 to 90 odd percent, and generally with lower capital cost. Now, as efficiency gains in buildings and industry start to outpace economic growth, America's electricity demand could actually shrink even as the economy grows 2.6-fold, and even with the electrification of the autos. This will ease and speed the shift to new ways of making electricity, especially with renewables. China leads the explosive growth and the plummeting costs of renewable generators. In fact, some of the Chinese solar modules have lately fallen below $1 a watt. So wind power and even solar power are marketplace winners today. California's shareholder-owned utilities have just bought over 4 billion watts of solar power because it was cheaper than power from a new combined cycle gas plant. Already in a dozen states, private installers, some now to be financed by Google, can put those cheap photovoltaics on your house's roof with no money down and guarantee to beat your utility bill. Such unregulated products can deliver a virtual utility that does everything for you the utility does now, only at lower cost at a stable price with no emissions, with greater reliability and resilience. So it's the kind of bypass of power companies that we already saw when cell phones bypassed the wireline phone companies. This sort of thing, of course, gives utility executives the heebie-jeebies, but it gives venture capitalists sweet dreams. There are about a half dozen sensible business models that incumbent utilities can use to respond to or exploit this sort of threat or opportunity. Ostrich is not a good one. Now, the flip side of falling prices is renewables' explosive global growth. While orders for central power plants, thermal plants, wither because they cost too much and they have too much financial risk, renewables have actually added half of the world's total new generating capacity in the last 3 years. And renewables other than big hydro plants got last year $151 billion of private investment, and they surpassed the total installed capacity of nuclear power by adding 60 billion watts. 60 billion watts worth of solar power By the end of 2011, will be manufacturable every year. And that number's been growing 60-odd percent a year for a decade. In contrast, even before the Fukushima accident, new U.S. nuclear plants couldn't raise private capital despite 100-plus percent subsidies because they have no business case. But even without them, profitable non-nuclear, low or no carbon generators can displace all the U.S. coal plants cheaper than just running them and can displace them over 23 times cheaper than building a new one. But displacing them once suffices. Now, we're often told that only coal and nuclear plants can keep the lights on because they are supposedly 24/7, while wind and solar power are variable and hence supposedly unreliable. Well, actually, there isn't such a thing as a 24/7 power plant. They all break. Coal and nuclear plants are out of action about 10 to 14% of the time, and when that happens, you typically lose a billion watts of capacity in weeks or for weeks or months. You lose it in milliseconds, often with no warning. On the other hand, grids are designed to, and they do routinely handle that intermittence by backing up failed plants with working plants. And in just the same way, grids can offset the variability, the forecastable variability of wind and solar power, which are now more reliably predictable 4 days ahead than demand is, something that's varied for a long time. So our team's hourly simulations have shown that very large renewable fractions can deliver highly reliable power when they are forecasted, integrated, and diversified by both type and location. For example, after efficiency makes the 2050 load in the Texas area less peaky and a good deal smaller, you can add a good deal of wind and solar power, and they won't exactly match the load. However, flexible demand and smart charging and discharging of electrified autos as distributed storage can mesh all the moving parts, even with 86% variable renewables, and even more if we use more of the demand response resource. Then the other 14% or less can come from dispatchable renewables like geothermal, small hydro, solar thermal electric, even feedlot biogas burned in existing gas turbines. Some utilities already integrate variable renewables in exactly this way. Four German states last year got 43 to 52% of all their electricity from wind power. Portugal is 45% renewable power, Denmark 36%. And this proven choreography of variable and flexible resources can reliably serve steady loads, not in the traditional way of big thermal plants, which are steady when they operate, but rather with newer resources that meet even better the classical definition for baseload plants, namely they're the cheapest ones to operate. These are definitely cheaper because they have no fuel, and therefore you run them whenever they're available. Reinventing Fire explores four electricity futures that differ very little in net present valued cost, but they differ greatly in risk. We looked at business as usual, a new nuclear build and so-called clean coal future, a centralized renewable future, a distributed renewable future. Well, the first scenario, the business as usual, has a high climate risk. The first two have high financial and technology risks. The first three are vulnerable to cascading and potentially nation-shattering blackouts caused by solar storms, other natural disasters, or terrorist attacks. But that risk disappears as distributed renewables let us reorganize the grid into so-called microgrids that locally provide power locally. They normally interconnect, but if the big grid around them goes down, they can isolate and continue to run their critical loads. They can stand a load at need. That's what our house does. Judy and I don't even know when the power goes off. We just know that it happened because afterwards my printer, which is not on a critical circuit, turns back on, and I can hear that, so I know there was a power failure, but nothing else is affected. So this distributed renewable scenario best handles the existential problem of cascading regional or national blackouts. It also best manages all the other risks. It costs about the same as business as usual, and it would maximize customer choice, entrepreneurial opportunity, and innovation. Now, together, efficient use and diverse, dispersed, or distributed renewable supply are starting to flip the whole electricity system on its head. Traditionally, utilities bought a lot of big coal and nuclear plants, quite a lot of gas plants, and a little bit of efficiency and renewables. Those utilities were rewarded, as they still are in 36 states, for selling you more electricity. That's just as dumb as it sounds. But now, especially where regulators, as in California, reward cutting your bills, the market is shifting massively towards other way up. Efficiency, renewables, combined heat and power, ways to meld all these resources together reliably with less transmission and little or no bulk electricity storage. And both U.S. and European analyses confirm in rich detail that 80 to 100% renewable electricity is feasible, reliable, and very cost-effective. These best buys also turn out to be the most effective solutions to climate change, nuclear proliferation, energy insecurity, energy poverty. Now, combine the electricity and oil revolutions, efficient buildings and factories, and saving directly used fuel, and you get the really big story, reinventing fire, where business enabled and sped by smart policies in mindful markets can lead the United States completely off oil and coal by 2050, saving $5 trillion, saving much risk and insecurity, and reducing fossil carbon emissions by 82 to 86% as a better than free byproduct. So our energy future is not fate but choice, and that choice is very flexible. In 1976, for example, government and industry all agreed that the energy used to make a dollar of GDP could never go down. I heretically suggested it could drop by several fold, and that's what happened, by twofold so far, with more to come. To solve the energy problem, we just needed to enlarge it. The results may at first seem incredible, but as Marshall McLuhan said, only puny secrets need protection. Big discoveries are protected by public incredulity. Rocky Mountain Institute's implementation initiatives are helping smart companies speed this journey. Of course, there's still a good deal of old thinking around as well. As Oilman Morris Strong said, not all the fossils are in the fuel. but as DuPont's chairman Edgar Woolard reminded us, firms hampered by old thinking won't be a problem, because they simply won't be around long term. What I've described here is not simply a once-in-a-civilization business opportunity to create the biggest ever shift in infrastructure. It's really one of the most profound transformations in the whole history of our species. Humans are inventing a new fire, not dug from below, but flowing from above, not scarce, but bountiful. Not local, but everywhere. Not transient, but permanent. Not costly, but free. And but for a little biofuel grown in ways that sustain and endure, this new fire is flameless, doing the job of the old fire, but without the combustion. Efficiently used, the new fire can make energy do our work without working our undoing. So please consider how we can together help make the world richer, fairer, cooler, and safer by reinventing fire. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Amory Lovins, founder and head of the Rocky Mountain Institute, speaking on the subject of reinventing fire. Now it is time for our question period from the audience. And so I'm going to lead off with the first question while the audience members get ready to ask theirs. And that is the high that I felt today listening to you is contrasted with the low that I feel every day reading about politics, especially in Washington, D.C. And it was very encouraging to me to hear you say at the beginning of your talk that all of these wonderful improvements that are achievable without a government role. How true is that? And don't we need some kind of help from a somewhat functional government?
I didn't actually say without a government role. I said without an act of Congress. We have governments at many other levels, which serve as a nice diverse set of laboratories. Enabling and speeding the business adoption with the compelling business logics that I briefly sketched here does require some new public policies. Fortunately, none of them has to be done by an act of Congress. They can all be done either administratively at a federal level or legislatively or administratively at a state level. I mentioned briefly the two biggest ones, aligning utility with customer incentives. Well, 16 states have done that already for electricity and 20-odd for natural gas, but we make those policies at a state level in the utility commissions or legislatures. The other big one is size and revenue-neutral fee rates for new autos, but that doesn't have to be a federal law either. California actually passed such a law in, I believe, 1980 by a 7-to-1 margin, but the issue hadn't been properly worked ahead of time with the automakers, and one was for it, but another was neutral, and Governor Duke Bajan pocket vetoed the legislation, which then got bottled up. On the other hand, having now worked in the auto industry about how to design fee baits to be attractive to them and good for everybody so they can make more money and sell more cars and so on, I think this politically could work very well, and indeed it has 3/4 or more poll support in California. Now, California happens to have 16 other states that work with it under the Clean Air Act, and together they are 2/5 of the U.S. auto market, so that's enough to swing the whole thing. There is one trivial exception to what I said about not needing federal law. It would be really nice to harmonize federal with state regulations on truck size and weight so that we could hook two trailers to one tractor in a way that reduces road wear and improves safety and saves a great deal of fuel and money. But by not doing that, if we didn't have the federal concurrence, you would only have an extra 250,000 barrels a day of advanced biofuel demand in 2050 out of a 3 million barrel a day demand. So it's not an important effect and can readily be dealt with.
Hi, thank you. Doug McKenzie from SolarTech. And I heard one wit say that the United States has the greatest universities, and at the same time, 40% of us believe that the Earth was created 10,000 years or less ago. So how can that public incredulity that you mentioned, that's rampant in our country, how can we cross that divide such that more people can understand the logic that you're showing us?
I think by speaking to people's concerns in their language, or as Saul Alinsky said, talking to folks where they're at, not where you're at, you will have noticed that adopting the approach that I just summarized doesn't require you to believe in climate science, let alone evolution. You don't have to know anything about science. You just have to care about national security or making money or staying healthy. Any of those will do. If you didn't care about any of those things, I suppose you might not be so interested, but that's probably a rather small number of Americans.
Okay. Thank you.
Dr. Levins, do you think that the availability of rare earth metals, for example, lithium in hybrid car batteries or neodymium in wind turbines, will limit the effectiveness and availability of renewable energy technologies?
Well, lithium is not a rare earth, and it's actually quite abundant as well as recycled in much the way that we recycle, say, nickel or lead in other batteries today. It's hard or impossible in most states to even buy a lead acid car battery without turning in your old one for recycling. And as we get more lithium batteries in circulation, similar processes are spreading commercially. Rare earth elements are a different matter. They're used in things like supermagnets. And having actually written some books on mining and worked with in the National Magnet Lab and being familiar with this area in a number of other ways as a physicist, I looked at this in some detail with my colleagues, and if you go on the internet and search Lovins Rare Earth, I expect you will find rather quickly my letter posted to the Joint Force Quarterly blog, which is the magazine of the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, explaining why this is not a serious concern. There are very, very few uses of rare earths that are not substitutable with comparable or better economics and performance, and those are extremely small uses. To take the most obvious one of magnets, there are at least two well-proven ways to make motors with comparable or better performance to permanent magnet motors in terms of weight, power, durability, cost, all the things that automakers care about, that use no magnets. Not just different magnets, but no magnets at all. One of those is the well-known induction motor, which is used, say, in the Tesla, and another is called a switch reluctance motor, an innovation mainly from the north of England, and that can actually beat or match a permanent magnet motor on any criteria if it's properly designed. So, of course, there was a big rare earth scare about a year ago because China was producing about 95% of the stuff, and we had allowed a U.S. mine and mill to be shut down, and it'll take a few years to get back online. And China started to make noises about restricting exports and so on. But meanwhile, the Geological Survey has pointed out there's about 1,300 years' worth of rare earth supply in the United States that we haven't bothered to mine because it was cheaper elsewhere, but not by a lot. The rare earth prices have since fallen by at least half. It was basically a bubble hype by stock promoters. Sir.
For those of us who have followed RMI.org's infiltration of the business system in this country and others, for those of us who have read Natural Capitalism and thought that it would create quite a wave of change, and it has, who read with great interest Peak Oil and thought it would create an unbelievable change, and while it has, there still is a huge gap between what most politicians, most government officials, most of the people in the most important positions who have heard you, because we read that you have been invited to so many places, including the White House, but there still is this huge gap between putting into play the wisdom and elegance that you have given us over the years. What's it going to take?
I think the most, thank you, that was Arthur Young. I think the most important place to start is not waiting for the government to tell us what to do and what unnatural act they want us to commit in the marketplace, but rather to get on with innovating and making money, which American enterprise is very good at. In other words, let's use our most effective institutions, private enterprise co-evolving with civil society and the military, to end run the ineffective institutions. I know this will come as a great surprise to those inside the Beltway, but actually their concurrence and action is not necessary to bring about what I've described. And it might be quite salutary for them to look out to the rest of the country and see what is being achieved at a state and local level, and particularly in the private sector, for whom we largely wrote Reinventing Fire.
Thank you, Amory.
So in 2006, I just decided to give up oil, and I got a diesel car and switched to biodiesel. And it's sort of ideal because if you run out of biodiesel, you can just pull up to a pump and put in regular diesel. And as I looked to buy an electric car, you know, once you hit the range of the car, you're going to be sitting there for hours waiting for the thing to charge. What do you see as a solution to that? Like, how can you get that experience of pulling up to the pump and now having brand new electricity in your car immediately?
There are several ways around the lower energy content of batteries than fuel per pound. One is to take half or two-thirds of the weight and drag out of the car. And I describe that as a way to need fewer batteries so you can afford the car very much sooner. But, of course, you could also take the benefit in increased range from the same batteries. Any trade-off will work. And I expect that in fleet vehicles, which are bought unemotionally on a spreadsheet, the choice will probably be for more range where required. But then you also have to realize that most trips are quite short. For example, Judy and I have been trying out a 2012, about to be released, Prius plug-in hybrid, and it only has a 14-mile electric range, a lot less than most plug-in hybrids that are 40 miles plus, and yet we're getting 95 miles a gallon on it. And all that happens is after you run out of the 14 miles worth of electricity, if you're doing more than a local trip, then you're running on a hybrid gasoline engine, which could, of course, be a biofuel if you want. And then it's just like a regular Prius, except you're carrying around the extra batteries. well, 95 miles a gallon is pretty good. And batteries are also getting better. And when you put all that together, I think the plug-in hybrids, the range extender designs like the Chevrolet Volt or the range extender option for the BMW i3 coming out in 2013, will be very attractive to a lot of people because those have, you know, perfectly normal range. And in the case of the BMW, since the car is carbon fiber, it gets significantly lighter, and therefore it takes less motor to run it. So the electric motor is smaller. If you get the range extender option, that teensy little engine fits between the rear wheels right alongside the motor. You don't need any more space out of the car. There are no packaging implications to adding that option. So, again, the lighter the cars get, the more slippery they get, the better tires they get, the easier and cheaper all this becomes. And I think we'll find that through a combination of those options, range anxiety goes away pretty quickly. Obviously, the more we spread charging infrastructure, and the faster the charging becomes, the easier it is too. And the lighter your car is, the fewer batteries it has, the faster they charge. So that even means that you can get fairly rapid charging without even going to 220 volts. So the infrastructure isn't an issue either because you can plug in anywhere. Yeah.
Yes, we read about cloud computing and cloud farms. Have you turned any of your attention to cloud farms and making them more efficient?
Are you thinking of data centers?
Yes.
Yes, as opposed to agricultural farms fed by cloud dew. Yes. yeah, we have actually designed a number of data centers. Our last big design was only tripled efficiency at normal cost because the client wouldn't allow EDS, now part of Hewlett-Packard, to adopt many of our recommendations. But EDS told us had they done so, they would have saved about 95% of the energy and half the capital cost. And today's technology is even better. It's very much like the story I told you about starting your savings downstream in a pumping system by taking friction out of the pipes, and then you need smaller pumps, smaller motors, smaller electricals. If you look at the energy flow through a data center, much less than 1% of the energy you feed in to the power plant actually comes out the data center as customer value. There are so many compounding losses along the way. So if we start at the downstream end, that would mean writing terse code elegantly compiled so that every compute cycle is a needed and wanted one. Then we would use roughly quadrupled efficiency servers, and then they need a lot less cooling and power supply, and there are much more efficient ways to provide those. You don't even need half the losses at the power plant. You can do on-site fuel cell trigeneration. When you put all this together, you get roughly 100-fold leverage from the savings all the way downstream in your business processes and code and compilation back to the fuel at the power plant. So it's an extraordinarily rewarding business opportunity. And we've helped with this and other work and many colleagues in the industry to spark quite a revolution in how data centers are designed. So we think their energy use will continue to drop quite steadily for a very long time.
Thank you.
I would like to know if you can make a recommendation or give us a source for recommendation for companies that you think are forward-thinking and will be working well in terms of investments in utility building, automobiles, or batteries.
I cannot legally do that, but if I could, the advice would be worth what you paid for it. Sir.
Hi. As you probably know, the a freight train is up to 10 times as efficient as a truck. And so I'm wondering, given the significant efficiency advantages as well as urban design advantages of trains, what is your view of railways and their role in the new era?
Part of the $0.3 trillion of truck productivity savings actually does come from continuing the shift of long-distance freight from truck to rail. And rail itself can get considerably more efficient. So that's all described in Reinventing Fire. Very good point. And, of course, it's also true of moving people, not just goods. a lot of inter-urban, fairly short-hop air can now be cost and time-effectively replaced with high-speed rail. And there are even new categories of vehicles. For example, there's something called Cybertran, C-Y-B-E-R-T-R-A-N, that you can look up on the web, that's an ultralight rail vehicle, many times cheaper than conventional light rail. And it's been sitting around undeployed for 20 years because it doesn't fit any of the recognized federal categories for a rail vehicle. So they don't have a program to put it in, but I just heard the other day this logjam may finally be starting to break so we can actually get the thing built. And it has remarkable versatility from running around the middle of a city to going between cities at quite high speed.
Thank you.
Sir.
Hi. I had the pleasure of reading Natural Capitalism and one of your other books just a couple of years ago. One of the things I really like about your books, at least the ones I read, were that you footnote the claims that you make. And
my favorite unit is said to be footnotes per furlong.
in one of the things that caught my eye is that you had mentioned that it's possible to design buildings. So
they
use. It's possible to design buildings so that they use absolutely no energy for heating or cooling. And in your footnotes, you cited a building being built in Idaho and another one in England. When I actually checked, this being some years after the books had come out, these buildings had not been built. And I understand maybe RMI is such a building, but is there a building not sort of oriented towards an energy-free future, but just built that follows this passive design?
Yeah, actually, Judy and I live in a passive solar banana farm at 7,100 feet in the Rockies, where before global warming, it used to go down to minus 47 F on occasion, and we're now harvesting, and well, we just harvested, we're ripening our 36th banana crop and working on our next set of 15 papayas with no furnace, and it was about $1,100 cheaper to build that way. But that helped inspire what is called the passive house movement. And there are about 25,000 buildings now in Europe, including climates from, say, southern Sweden to central Norway, that have no heating equipment. They don't need it, and they cost about normal to build. The extra cost now ranges from about minus 3% to plus 5%, roughly. and it's converging to about zero. It's the same trick we did. You pay for things like super windows and super insulation and ventilation heat recovery by not needing a heating system. You optimize the house as a system, not the insulation as a component. So, yes, we've so far done this trick in actual measured buildings from about minus 47 to plus 115 F. That was in a dry climate in California in a PG&E project. However, it even works in very humid climates. An architecture professor in Bangkok visited our house in the 90s and said, oh, I'm going to build a house in Bangkok. We have the opposite climate. We're hot and wet. You're cold and dry. But I think if we apply the same kind of integrative design principles, we can do pretty well. So I went and visited his house. He's saving 90% of his air conditioning energy at normal construction cost with better comfort. So between his climate and ours, probably everyone in the world lives, except perhaps a few Inuit. So this has come along nicely. And if you want to know more about passive building in the United States, get hold of the Affordable Comfort Institute.
Hi, I'm Leila Salazar-Lopez with Amazon Watch. And I know you've been talking to some of my colleagues at Amazon Watch over the last couple of months. I'm just wondering, how do we bring this message to the international community? And I'm thinking particularly Latin America, as Chile is planning to build some of the biggest dams in the world in Patagonia.
We're going there in a few weeks to talk to them about that.
Wonderful. And Brazil is planning to build the third largest dam and many, many more dams throughout the entire Amazon. And one of the main reasons that they say they're doing that is because they need energy. They need clean, renewable energy mega dams for Rio Plus 20, for the World Cup, and for the Olympics. And I'm wondering, is it possible to build green buildings, green stadiums, and really diversify the grid in Brazil in a quick amount of time?
It certainly would be. The obstacles are political, not technical or economic. And I have worked some in Brazil with my colleagues on this sort of issue. In developing countries, as in our own, most of the electricity is wasted, except that they can less afford the waste, and they have a greater opportunity to overcome it readily, because in countries like, say, China and India, much of the infrastructure hasn't yet been built. It's being built in the next few decades, mm-hmm. and it's a lot easier to build things right than fix them later. So the countries that have the most waste, the most inefficiency, and can least afford it, are in the best position to fix it. And remember that brains are, as Gifford and Libet-Pinchot say, brains are evenly distributed, one per person. So most of the brains are in countries like China and India. There's enormous innovation going on there from which we can learn a lot if we have the humility to listen. So I'm actually quite encouraged by how well this is going. And fortunately, the mega dams you describe have very bad economics by the time you count the cost of the long transmission lines and, indeed, the vulnerability of those lines needed to bring the power to the load centers. So I think it will turn out that the efficiency and distributed renewable solutions are a better buy with less risk.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker is Amory Lovins, founder and president of the Rocky Mountain Institute. Now we've reached the time in our program where we have time for just one last question. Do we have one last question?
Hello, my name is Simone Hudson, and I'm a student at the Urban School of San Francisco. So could you please comment on what I perceive to be a contradictory pairing of the ideas of a growth-based market economy and the principles of conservation?
We have assumed a 2.6-fold bigger economy because that is the official projection. Actually, the official projection ends in 2035, and we simply extrapolated to 2050 because we want to look at the next 40 years. We're not saying whether it's a good idea. We're saying if you wanted to run that sort of economy, you could do it $5 trillion cheaper with no oil, coal, nuclear, et cetera. by taking economics seriously. The much larger question you raise is an extremely important one about what is growing, for whose benefit, who decides, and does it actually make us better off and better human beings? All faith traditions counsel us against materialism. I believe Ecclesiastes says, for example, he that hath silver shall not be satisfied with silver, nor he that hath abundance with increase. This is also vanity. And those of you who have seen the little viral video from Annie Leonard about the story of stuff and a new one she's coming out with about growth will be very focused on the notion that markets are very good at allocating scarce resources, but they are meant to be efficient, not sufficient, greedy, not fair. They're not meant to tell us how much is enough. And as Dana Meadows reminds us, it is silly and futile to try to meet non-material needs by material means. So these deeper questions about the purpose of the economic process are very important and are certainly coming to the fore as we get more and more social science evidence that more stuff is not actually making us happier. So that is beyond the scope of our synthesis, but I think these are vital questions to pursue in the realm of politics and ethics.
Please join me in thanking Amory Lovins for his remarks here today. This program of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.